Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Every new parent, and even those who've been doing this for a while, struggle with how much dirt you should let your child be exposed to. Questions like that, whether or not your child needs antibiotics or even antibacterial wipes, are all tackled by microbial biologist Jack Gilbert of Argonne National Laboratory and the University of Chicago in his new book, Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. Hey, Jack, welcome back. Thanks for being here with me. It's fun to have you here. We're in Jackson's studio with me here in Chicago. So you start this book with two really personal stories, the birth of your son, the birth of your one of your co-author's children, so your co-author, Rob Knight. Can you share the story of what happened when your eldest son was born?
Yeah, so it was, you know, as every new parent will tell you, it was quite a traumatic experience as well as a joyous experience. But, you know, we had to wait in the room, in the hospital room, for quite some time, waiting for a doctor to turn up, and my wife was told not to push, right? So she was desperate to push. She'd been in labor for approximately 8 hours by that point, and she felt it was ready. She wanted to go through. They had her lying on her back, which she felt uncomfortable with, and there was a lot of preamble with the nurses about, you know, you have to do it this way, you have to do it this way. And then so she was not allowed to push, and my eldest son's head was bashing up against the pelvis, right? And so he was born in a distressed state when the doctor, who I don't know why we needed a doctor to allow my wife to push, but who finally arrived in the operating room and basically said, no, go for it, push. And she did, and he came out. But by that time, he'd already voided his bowels in the birth canal. And this is called meconium, right? It's a mech. And there was a hypothesis some time ago that this could cause an infection in their lungs if they inhaled it. So he was immediately given antibiotics. And new parent, and I was only 30 years old at the time, I was like, no, do whatever you need to do, absolutely. And it was interesting, in researching this book, we found out that the application of those antibiotics was completely and utterly not called for. The idea that you could give a child antibiotics at birth was purely, well, it can't hurt, so why not? You know, mm-hmm. like it's better safe than, you know, sorry. And in this instance, it turned out that actually antibiotic administration very early in life could have caused disruptions in his microbiome, which, you know, could have led to any number of complications.
Right.
But we didn't know that then, right?
Right. Well, and maybe we should take a step back and talk about and explain exactly what our microbiome is, because this is your field of research.
Right. So our microbiome is the bacteria, the virus, the fungi, the ecosystem of microbes that live inside us. There's around 2 pounds of them living in your gut, but they're all over your skin, over every surface you can imagine. You have microbes swimming in front of your eyes. You just can't see them, right? They're very, very small. And they contain lots of genetic information. They themselves are powerhouses, like little factories that produce resources that your body needs. They help you digest your food. They help train your immune system. They even produce chemicals that stimulate your muscle growth and your bone growth and even your brain development, right? So we know that they're incredibly important for our health and well-being. And when we disrupt them, when we change the composition of them in a negative way, removing good ones and maybe allowing bad ones to grow, we can actually end up with a negative health consequence. Something bad can happen and occasionally does.
But we're born with a clean slate.
Essentially, yeah. As soon as the amniotic sac, that's the sac that contains you as a fetus, as soon as that ruptures, you're then exposed to all the microbes in your mother, right? So as you pass down
which
the
is a
birth
good thing.
Oh, we think it's a, you know, well, you've evolved with it.
Right.
All of your ancestors went through that process, right? Of traveling down the birth canal and being slathered in this vaginal microbiota that gets covered the baby. And then all of the kisses and the hugs and that skin contact. Yeah, you know, it's good for emotional bonding, but it's also good for microbiome bonding because you get that microbial exposure in the child very early in life. And then even breast milk has bacteria in it, right? So feeding the baby breast milk, which has nutrients which only feed the bacteria in the gut, have nothing to do with human nutrition. They're there. Breast milk is designed to feed microbes in the intestine.
So I was fascinated by this. There's a lot that I learned in your book, but the breast milk one was really interesting to me because you have done research on this, that it's actually, it's not just nutrients for the baby, it's actually nutrients for your gut bacteria.
Right. We have these human milk oligosaccharides, right? So they're like long sugars. And these sugars are designed to be consumed purely by bacteria. The human body doesn't need them. They're not there for our nutrition. They're there to feed bacteria. And there's a reason for
and
this.
Why is that? Yeah, why is that important?
Because the bacteria are like your first line of defense against infection, right? They literally, if you populate your body, and your body's designed to do this, right? You populate your body with a beneficial microbial community and a microbial ecology, like a forest around you. It prevents bad things from coming in and taking over. In the absence of those microbes, bad bacteria, bad viruses can rapidly take over your body and cause infection and kill you, right? So kind of want them.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to ask you, you and Rob, who wrote this book, it tackles a lot of female health topics. We've been talking about childbirth, pregnancy, breastfeeding. Why did two male scientists want to do that?
I know, right? There's a gender bias. We do have Sandra Blakeslee, who's our other co-author. She's a passionate science writer. She was the first female science writer in the United States, the second female journalist at the New York Times in 1962. She's 74 years old and can race me up a hill on a bike and beat me every time, right? So I agree. You know, why would...
No, I'm just curious why you chose that, because you do go into all of these different topics.
I love my children, right? That's the key thing. And Rob's got a daughter. He loves her. And, you know, we're very passionate about finding ways to help treat other children so they don't suffer from conditions that many kids suffer from nowadays, like asthma and food allergies and eczema and neurodevelopmental conditions like autism problems with school, you know, like school readiness and all these kinds of things. Diabetes, we want to make sure that children grow up and are exposed to the right kinds of things and are brought up healthy. But more importantly, than that, you know, every time you ask a man a question, we try and solve it, right? That's a problem. Like, you just want to complain. You know, I just stop trying to answer my questions. Just let me complain, okay? I get that, but I really want to have questions answered. So for us, it was really important. We went through some traumatic experiences, and we wanted to empower parents with the knowledge that we had gained through scientific investigation, through clinical research, right? We wanted to empower people with that knowledge so that then when they were faced with those trials, they could deal with it. Right?
Well, and back to the breastfeeding question, right? Because your co-author, Rob, had a situation. I was actually just talking to a friend about this week. Who wasn't able to nurse her daughters and was shamed for it. And we had a long conversation about how frustrating it was that she felt like this is something she wanted to do and her body couldn't do. And then everyone made her feel bad about it. And you guys talk about this.
Yeah, it's a horrible situation, right? This shaming in our society is prolific. And in this instance, yeah, I mean, you should never feel shamed if your body can't do what it's, you know, what you hope it could do, right? Men have suffered from that for many years, don't worry. But in this instance, yeah, there's a real problem in dealing with the methodologies which could be applied to people, the learning and education which could be given to mothers to help them breastfeed, right, when they can't. But then if they really physiologically can't, there are lots of other options. There are milk banks.
Right, which is what your co-author did.
Right. It's expensive. You know, getting milk from a reliable, well-curated milk bank that's out there. A doula nurse would potentially be another option. So providing somebody who could come in and help breastfeed the child. They're all expensive options, though. And, you know, for a lot of the people in our society, they are completely out of the remit. We hopefully will get to a time when you could include those on your medical insurance, right, as an actual necessary expense to help with preventing later diseases, which would cost the insurance companies much more money, right? So we're not there yet. We need far more evidence to support the development of that, because that's the way our medical system works.
And I was interested in that story, though, because your co-author did end up using formula as well. But it did in a very interesting scientific way in terms of looking at the research, right?
Right. So we know that, you know, certain formulas are better than others in terms of how they help the bacteria in your gut grow and how they stimulate your immune response. So, yeah, he worked very extensively in trying to understand which kinds of formulas could be applied and how to balance this necessity for human milk with a necessity for actually living your life without going bankrupt, right? So, there's a lot of research that's being done in that space and lots which we need to do more of.
My guest is Jack Gilbert. His new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. If you have questions for us, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We got a question on Twitter from Chicago saying, fun fact, backyard dirt may be poop, and then asking how much of backyard dirt is actually fecal matter and can we get illnesses from it?
Nearly all of the dirt and or soil, right? You've got to be careful with it.
There's a difference between dirt and soil.
There is, yeah. I mean, you know, not in the popular imagination, but from a scientific discipline.
So give us this, go, maybe you should explain that then.
Well, I mean, like dirt is just a vernacular term used to describe anything.
Anything, right.
Yeah, right. But soil in the backyard is really what we're referring to in terms of, you know, go out there and get muddy, right? And a lot of the soil out there, as long as you are not concerned about there being too many heavy metal pollutants or industrial waste or, you know, organic pesticides or inorganic pesticides that have contaminated that soil, you'd have to consume a lot of that soil. A child would have to consume a lot of that soil to poison them. But bear in mind, soil is basically reconstituted plant matter. It's already been through the intestine of thousands of insects. It's been digested by bacteria and fungi. So all soil is poop, right? If you look at it literally.
Okay.
But yeah, if you're worried about an area where your dog goes and does their business in the morning, or if you're living on a farmyard and you're worried, you know, if your child's playing in a cow pat, you know, like a cow patty in the field, yeah, you might want to observe them and make sure that they're, you know, they're staying healthy and they're not coming down with any kind of inflammation or temperature. But on the whole, even those kind of environments aren't necessarily dangerous. Yes, there is always the possibility that a child could get an infection. But what we're concerned about is the fact that the possibility of an infection is quite low, extremely low in many cases, and the possibility of beneficial interaction with that environment is quite high. So balancing your perspectives and using common sense, you know, we want... Too many times people want exact instructions. Tell me exactly what I should do so I don't make a mistake. Well, you're allowed to make mistakes. As a parent, you know that, right? You learn that very quickly. And mistakes happen, but getting out there and experiencing the world in a more holistic fashion is not a bad thing.
And that's why you guys got a dog.
Right, yeah. So we know from clinical studies that having exposure to dog bacteria, pardon me, and dog viruses, it can actually help to stimulate the immune response of a child and prevent them from developing things like asthma and allergies and eczema, right? Now, you know, the evidence out there may be a little bit scant in the fact that we haven't done a huge number of double-blind clinical trials with placebos, because how do you create a placebo for a dog, right, that allows us to determine their pure efficacy. But we went and rescued two dogs. The dogs got a better life. My children are exposed to the right kind of environment, and they love going outside and walking them.
But they're not allergic to them, because there's a whole other question, right, about allergies and what kind of role allergies play also with our microbiome, and particularly with our gut bacteria.
Yeah, there's an interesting paradigm. If your child is exposed to a dog, and when I mean exposed, they're allowed to interact physically with the dog. The dog licks their face, they lick the dog's face, whatever happens, you know. If they're allowed to do that kind of physical interaction with the dog under the age of one, they have an almost a highly significant reduction in the likelihood of developing an allergy to the dog.
Oh, interesting.
But if it happens afterwards,
after
right,
age one.
Yeah. If they haven't had any exposure and they've lived a relatively sterile life, then what happens, their immune system generally becomes more pro-inflammatory, right? It's more sensitized to allergens that come from the outside. It hasn't been trained enough. I like to think of the immune system in an infant that isn't exposed to any bacteria as being old and grumpy. So when something new comes into it, it gets very inflamed very rapidly. And so we see, lack of exposure early on can lead to more allergies later on.
And so under age one, is that sort of the key time from birth to one that we see, that you think about, that you have, really, are you thinking about exposure to different allergens?
Absolutely, yeah. So, if a child is exposed to, orally exposed, like they're consuming peanuts, for example, under the age of one, they're less likely to develop a peanut allergy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, know, and that's a huge controversy. But, you know, that now the National Allergy Association is saying, yes, absolutely, please, yeah, let's consider
oral
consumption.
Right, those are the new guidelines. Right. And so then the same thing goes for anything else, you would say, for dirt, for pollen, for pets and all of those sorts
right.
of things.
Yeah, bear in mind, your children nowadays, thankfully, are protected against the vast majority of extremely highly contagious infective agents, you know, bacteria and viruses which will kill you. So we've got that protection in place. Vaccines and public health works have done their job, right? But we can't live that sanitary lifestyle where we are completely cutting off our children from that exposure. It's too dangerous.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jack Gilbert, talking about all of these things, germs, bacteria, kids. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come on this special Encore edition of The 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. We're talking about germs and bacteria in kids with microbial biologist Jack Gilbert. He's the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Laboratory. He's also a professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. Lynn on Twitter wants to know what you think about the current data on pre-birth exposure, and maybe you should explain what pre-birth exposure is, Jack.
Yeah, so what we call pre-birth exposure is there's two phases of this, right? Number one, what's your mother being exposed to even before she gets pregnant, right?
Okay.
How her immune system, her microbiome, her physiological health. What's the status of that and how could that affect the pregnancy and the development of pregnancy? And then also, of course, when the mother is pregnant, the kinds of exposures she gets and how that affects the developing fetus. There's some, personally, we're doing some really interesting research in this space. We work with animal models mostly, right, because we do everything in preclinical phase. We can't just go around randomly experimenting on humans, however much I would love to do that. But essentially what we do is we look at how the mother will respond to a viral infection during pregnancy. And a mother that gets a virus infection during pregnancy can actually have an increased risk of a preterm birth, increased risk of placental damage, and even developmental problems in the fetus, which can lead to neurological problems in the developing child, right? And when the child's born, they can have things like autism or other neurodevelopmental problems. And what we've shown is that by increasing the integrity of the microbial ecosystem, by strengthening the microbial ecosystem in the gut during the pregnancy in our animal models, we can actually significantly reduce the likelihood that when we expose that animal to a virus, that it will affect the pregnancy at all. So the fetus is protected from the virus infection by the mother's gastrointestinal microbial environment. So gut health may be a key phase in helping to prevent the development of some of these conditions which children suffer from, and maybe even reducing preterm birth.
So then gut health gets us to probiotics, right? Because I feel like this is the new thing. Everybody is really into probiotics and how this is going to help boost our immune system. This is also a very new area of research. Mm-hmm. First of all, can you explain, what do we know about probiotics?
Well, listen, probiotics is surprisingly not new. We've known that microbial exposure from fermented foods, for example, so yogurts and kefir and fermented milk products generally, and even other fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut, can actually be beneficial, right? Over the last 100 years, 150 years, there have been experiments done with these foodstuff by nutritionists that have suggested they can be beneficial. The problem is we now got into this idea that we don't want to ferment our own food at home. You know,
you want to take a pill that's a probiotic.
Right, exactly.
Or a drink, a
and
shot.
We have no evidence that any of these pills, which are like sanitized versions of the home-brewed kefir or home-brewed, you know, yogurts that we had at home, whether this pill is a sanitized version of that, we have no real evidence that it's beneficial in maintaining health, right? We do have a lot of evidence that taking a probiotic when you're sick, so for example, if you have diarrhea, you could take a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG, and it can be highly effective in treating the diarrhea. And there are many other probiotics which have been applied in double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trials. That's our gold standard to show that it works, it's effective, that have shown that probiotics can be useful in treating infections and other maladies, right? Including things like depression, which is quite surprising, you'd think, you know, but you take a probiotic and it can affect how your brain works. And things like rheumatoid arthritis. So we know that there are benefits from taking probiotics. But I would argue that until we have a better handle on how to measure health, we're going to struggle to prove that continuous consumption of a pill containing a few organisms in a few hundred billion cells, right, is actually beneficial for maintaining health.
Well, and what do we know about the probiotics that are commercially available as well? There's really only like one or two different strains, right? There's lots of different, and you have in your book, you have a great chart that sort of explains different strains and what, as you've said, what clinical trials have shown are very helpful.
Right.
But I feel like when you look at labels of all of the commercially available stuff, it seems like kind of there's like two or they'd say like this has this many strains of this active culture.
Right. I mean, there are probably 15 to 20 strains that are commonly used in a range of probiotics you could buy in your drugstore or your supermarket. What do you call them? Not supermarket, that's the English
grocery
phrase.
Store.
Grocery store, thank you. And they're owned by approximately two or three companies, right? There are two or three companies that own probably 95% of all the probiotics out there.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're pretty much just recapitulations of the same thing with different branding. And you know, for the most part, there's limited evidence to support their efficacy. But there are some out there. There are a couple that have good clinical data to support their treatment of certain conditions. Like there's one that has been shown to treat irritable bowel disorder, or at least lessen the symptoms of irritable bowel disorder to a certain extent, right? And others that have been shown to treat diarrhea, others have been shown to treat rheumatoid arthritis, others that have been shown to affect change in your susceptibility to viral infections. The data is still limited. The companies are unregulated in their ability to produce some of these products. So unless they're going to make a very specific claim, which would require FDA approval and make them show that they aren't snake oil, right? unless they're going to make that specific claim, they can make any claim they really want to.
My guest is Jack Gilbert. We're talking about probiotics right now. One of the topics of his book, which is called his new book, just out in the past couple of weeks, is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. And as you say that, I wonder, as a scientist, what your thoughts are about a placebo effect of taking
right.
these things. Like, does the fact that we're taking something like like I was telling you before we went on air that I went through this phase where I was doing like a probiotic for I would just do it for like 7 days. And then I did feel like when I was around my nieces and nephews who had like pretty bad stomach illnesses that I got off a little easier than they did. But that's, as you would say, that's not a science. That's not a clinical trial,
unfortunately,
right?
I mean, that's we call that an N of one study. There's you.
Right.
And, who knows what's going on inside you at that time.
Right.
You could have just not picked up the bug, which your nieces and nephews
right.
had. We require more evidence to support claims, right? And I think that's very important. And a placebo effect is a real thing. You know, if I tell you that this is going to help you, and I actually deal with this in the last chapter of the book, right?
Right, yeah.
If I talk to a patient
right.
and I say, this is going to make you feel better, they'll take it and they probably will feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it will cure their problem is very unlikely, right? So we have to be very, very careful about how we use our authority in relaying this science to the public. It's and you know, and you do as well as a journalist. It's a partnership, and it's an honor to be able to communicate the science to the public. But it's also a huge responsibility to make sure that we do it in an effective and controlled way.
Well, and you write about this, right? It's particularly hype when it comes to media issue of coverage pertaining to gut health. There's always sort of a new study about this or that. How do you want people, sort of the average public media listener or news consumer, to distinguish hype from truth when you're looking at sort of these issues?
Well, the cynical side of me is like, buy my book and read it, because that's the reason we wrote it, right? You know, in fact, when we put the idea to our publisher, or the number of publishers, they said, well, we can get all this information on the internet. I said, you can get a lot of information on the internet, right? And yes, you can, but how do you know which is the real information, which isn't? So, you know, coming from two scientists with well-established careers who really don't have a dog in the game, or a skin in the game, as it were, you know, with regards to the commercial application of this research, we wanted to show, yeah, we can basically encapsulate what is actually known about this research. And here it is. This is essentially what we know now, right? And what you can rely on. And it provides you with essentially it's an encyclopedia, right? I have questions
right, it
and
is.
Answers.
There's questions and answers. You can look them up. It's very helpful charts and things. That said, what do you think is one of the biggest myths that you want to dispel about bacteria and germs?
Oh, well, the biggest myth and the most obvious one, right, is that not all bacteria are bad. And I've had clinicians, I've had heads of hospitals stand up in my lectures sometimes and go, there's no such thing as a good bacteria. The only good bacteria is a dead bacteria, right? And that's just literally not true.
And do you think that the medical community has come around to sort of changing their thinking on that, or is that something that's a lot slower in terms of a cultural perspective?
It's we are going through a true Kuhnian paradigm shift, right? A true paradigm shift in the fact that the community, the social community, the business community, and the scientific community is undergoing a revolution in its understanding of the role of this microbial world inside us and outside us. And it's telling, I'm an ecologist, a microbial ecologist, but I'm now a professor of surgery, right? So the University of Chicago is actively embracing this research area and basically trying to transcend the basic environment and bring it into the clinical science so that we can help patients more effectively with these novel therapies.
Well, and how much of this also is just a recognition of where we are with antibiotic use, with the rise of different superbugs, is particularly in hospital settings, things like MRSA, people being very concerned about hospital-acquired illnesses and our ability to fight them off.
So we are actually changing that strategy as well, right? There's only so much we can clean something. And as soon as a human being goes into a cleaned space, they shed bacteria into that environment. And then they enter into this rapid equilibrium where they're picking up bacteria and shedding bacteria. You and I are sitting in this studio, and each of us is shedding 38 million bacterial cells into this environment every hour. So for the hour we're spending in here, we're shedding, you know, close to, you know, 70, 80 million.
And how long does it stay? So then how long does it stay?
Most of them die as soon as they hit this environment because it's dry and it's cold, right?
Okay.
And they can't survive. It's like a desert. I drop you in a desert, you're going to die, pretty much. But some will survive. The hardier ones will survive. And then you'll pick them up again. So you and I are sharing microbes. And my microbes are testing your immune system. Your microbes are testing my immune system. And the same thing happens in a hospital. Some of them go backwards and forwards, and as they do that, they develop antibiotic resistance. They develop virulence mechanisms which help them to attack the body more effectively. And those are the bugs we worry about. But instead of treating the hospital, what we're most interested in doing now, and this is new research, is to test or treat the microbes inside the patient. Make their microbial environment more robust, less sensitive to stress, right? Because your microbes get stressed as well, just the same as you do. And when we reduce their stress, they become less angry. They're less likely to attack our body.
So that said, as we think about, are we too clean? Do we clean our houses too much, or should we let them get dirtier? Are we thinking of using, everyone uses antibacterial wipes all the time? I think we've maybe learned a little bit to come away from just constant hand sanitizing. But what do you think about that?
It's a balance, and it's always an annoying answer, right? But you do not need to treat your home like a hospital. Right, you do not need to sterilize every surface with bleach. You do not need to bleach your floors and bleach your countertops and bleach your toilets and bleach your handrails. And the you do not need to use hand sanitization wipes in most instances. You need to apply common sense. If you're chopping up raw chicken in the kitchen, wash your hands afterwards and wash the surfaces with soapy water, right? You know, make sure you apply that common sense. That's logic, right? But you don't need to sterilize. The bacteria in the home, coming from your dog, coming from outside, they are not harmful in any particular way, unless your child or you have severe immunocompromisation, in which case you'll know to be careful, right? Or you're very, very unwell, in which case you should be in a hospital. Then the home environment is not a dangerous environment. But there's aesthetics. I like the house to be clean, right? I like it to look neat and tidy. That's purely my personality. But it doesn't mean that it has to be sterile. And there's a difference between hygiene and sterility.
And so does that mean, and you write about this, so you have the 5-second rule when right. you drink, right? I mean, can you, when your kids drop food on the ground or anyone does, the 5-second rule's okay?
My rule's probably more like 5 minutes, but you know, like okay. if the food falls on the floor, the likelihood that the food acquires a pathogen, which when you then pick it up and consume it and will make you violently sick, it's an infinitesimally small chance. Unless you drop it in a slum in Calcutta, for example, where there are people with endemic diseases and there's raw sewage on the ground, in which case you don't want to eat the food off the floor. If you drop it on your floor, it's incredibly unlikely you're going to pick up anything.
And would this also gets to, also, as we're thinking about cleanliness, I want to ask you one last question about antibiotics, because this is a really tough question for parents, right? In terms of, especially with children, what do you think of, we just have a couple minutes left here, but I wanted to kind of end by asking you about that.
Sure. So the best advice is, antibiotics are a line of defense which have saved millions and millions of lives. They are incredibly helpful. If you have an infection, you should probably take an antibiotic, but have an active discussion with your healthcare provider. Don't use them as a prophylactic, right? Somebody said that our president is now using them as a prophylactic. That's not a good idea, right? It's not a sensible thing to do, and it could lead to severe anxiety and depression. Maybe that's what's happening. We don't know. But in this instance, I would say have an honest discussion with your healthcare provider. They are nearly always willing to have that talk and to listen to you. They're more paranoid that you're going to ask them to give you an antibiotic now, and they'll just give it to you to get them out of their office.
So for your perspective, parents, caregivers, everyone just needs to be more empowered about,
right.
does my child really need antibiotics?
Absolutely.
And because you would say the same thing for adults as well.
Yeah, I ask that question every time I need to take one or my kids need to take one. Ask a question. Do I really need this?
Right. And I guess it's sort of a little bit of that is the philosophy of all of this, right? In terms of probiotics, dirt, all of these things.
Diet, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, just one last question before we wrap up. I wanted to just ask you about prebiotics really
right.
quickly.
Well, prebiotics are just food, right? So it's the food that feeds the microbes. So like those human milk oligosaccharides in breast milk that feed the bacteria, fiber, good sources of vegetable matter, good nutrients. They are prebiotics which feed your microbiome and can make them more healthier and stronger.
Yeah. So basically all of the things we thought we should consume before anyway, because they're healthy.
My
right?
mother tells me it's all what she knew already, right? So that's a good thing.
Jack Gilbert, we've been talking, is a professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Chicago. He's also the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Laboratory. And his new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. Jack, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nina.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was illegal or highly restricted in the U.S., women had few safe options to end unwanted pregnancies. Access to abortion is often seen as a polarizing religious issue, especially among conservative Christians. But decades ago, you might be surprised to learn that a group of middle-aged white male religious clergy members were outspoken abortion right advocates. Starting in 1967, across several cities in the U.S., including Chicago, more than 1,000 pastors, rabbis, and other religious leaders joined together to create a secret network to help women who wanted to terminate their pregnancies. It was called the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. They gave guidance. They even helped put women on planes to other states or countries where the procedure was legal. And it's all the subject of a new book called To Offer Compassion, A History of Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. Its co-authors, Pat Ralph and D.A. Dirk, are with me now. Pat, D.A., welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. It's great to
so
be
here. Thanks so much for having us.
Dee, I wonder, can you take us back to 1967 and that time? Because I imagine it was, most people might not think about the fact it was the 60s, and probably clergy were very divided along political lines in terms of being far left or far right.
Well, so interestingly, on the topic of abortion, we can talk more about this. Evangelicals weren't very active on the topic in the 60s, whereas liberal clergy, we would call them, were active in terms of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And they knew each other through this network of sort of activist clergy. And that's how they got together on the topic of abortion. Many of them were campus clergy and had young women coming to them in distress in particular. And so it became apparent to them that this was a place where, you know, along with the burgeoning feminist and women's rights movement, that this was an area of need for women who were coming to them in cases of great distress. And so in 1967, that's when the network actually was founded in New York City.
It was founded in New York City. Pat, I wonder if you can tell us how it was founded and who founded it here in Chicago, because I think when you think about particularly the 60s and you think about politics in Illinois, I imagine that there was sort of bipartisan opposition to abortion. I'm thinking of the role of the Catholic Church within the Democratic Party, particularly in Illinois then. Can you tell us a little bit about how it got started in Chicago, Pat?
Yes, it had started in 1967 in New York City, and one of the main organizers was Reverend Howard Moody there in New York, who was an American Baptist minister, and he knew other American Baptist ministers who were liberal, as he was, and involved in civil rights and in anti-war activism. And one of those was Reverend Spencer Parsons, who at the time was the dean of Rockefeller Chapel at the University of Chicago. And really, it wasn't difficult to set up such a service. All they really required was to set up a telephone answering machine and take calls, train their clergy to do the counseling, and find out-of-state licensed physicians that would be willing to perform the abortions. Once they had found the doctors, that was really the hardest part. So Moody did kind of badger Spencer Parsons to get started with a clergy consultation service in Chicago. Spencer Parsons called together about 40 clergy that he knew who were also involved in the same issues, and they came together and would take call. There would be two or three, usually, clergy people on call each week. Women would call a telephone answering line that just had an outgoing message telling them which clergy were available, and they'd make their own appointment and see the clergy person in person. So that was another rule of the group. They'd see the women in person, refer them out of state to out-of-state doctors to confuse jurisdictions.
D.A., was this mostly Protestant clergy?
It was many mainline Protestant clergy. We found that there were, as we said, American Baptists, which is different from Southern Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, Episcopalians. There were also Jewish clergy. No Orthodox that we could find, but Reform, particularly, and some conservative
rabbis.
And we, as we did the research, we found that there were some nuns and priests who were involved. Usually they would actually help people get to the Protestant clergy for consultation, or sometimes the Protestant clergy would refer them to Catholic clergy they knew after the abortion had taken place if they felt like they needed follow-up counseling. So it was a fairly broad network of, in particular, Protestant denominations and Jewish rabbis as well.
And Pat, I guess all of this had to be done secretly, or was this an open secret, or was this something?
It was a very open secret, because the group in New York announced themselves with a front page article in the New York Times.
Okay, so that's not secret at all, right?
No, they had no way of knowing. And around the country, in other places, sometimes they were listed under abortion in the old, you know, yellow pages of the phone book, which was how you used to find services of all kinds. So they had no way of knowing if they would be targeted by the police, because what they were doing was they realized, at least on the margins of legality, if not actively illegal. And in Chicago, there was one rabbi who was not the target of an investigation. In fact, they of the entire probably as many as 3,000 clergy counselors, only three ever faced any illegal ramification. One was Rabbi Max Tichton, who was head of Hillel at University of Chicago and headed the Midwestern chapter. And he was got caught up in an investigation of a doctor in Detroit. He had referred a woman to this doctor. The woman turned out to be a Michigan State police officer undercover. So he was charged as...
What was he charged accessory. With?
Well, with accessory to abortion. However, the charges came to nothing. The doctor's charges also came to virtually nothing, and he wound up moving to Buffalo and doing abortions there once abortion was legalized in New York. So the charges came to nothing, but there was some court goings-on, and he had a lawyer in Detroit following his case and was advised by his lawyer not to travel to Michigan, but he said he may have snuck in a few times because he was in charge of some of the Hillel chapters that were in the state of Michigan.
And Dia, you said that a lot of them wonder about if you can tell us a little bit about thousands of women use this network. Were a lot of them, as you said, were a lot of them younger women, like college students, or probably ran the gamut?
So in the research that we've done, we found that it runs the gamut. So as I said, you know, some of the clergy who were brought, the issue was brought to their attention, worked on campuses. But the women were diverse in terms of age, ethnicity and race, religion. So we estimate conservatively that the clergy, when they were, the service when it was active from 1967 to 1973, may have, and this is a conservative estimate based on the research of us, archival research and the research of others, upwards of 450,000 women between 1967 and 1973. And there was tremendous diversity, single women, married women, women of color, white women, Jewish women, Catholic women, Protestant women, women of all faiths, women of all gender, races, ethnicities, religions. So it was a fairly broad group. And the issue that they were very concerned about is clergy was also helping women who were, in particular, socioeconomically disadvantaged. They actually became, and Pat can talk more about this, she's very good about it, sort of a medical consumers union, in that when the clergy realized eventually the power of the number of referrals that they were doing and drove down the cost of abortions nationally.
Pat, can you add to that? Because I was wondering also about that, if women weren't able to afford them, how that also worked.
Well, in Chicago, I should say, in particular, there was the rule that they should always refer out of state for legal reasons. Spencer Parsons, who was in charge in Chicago, reserved to himself the option to refer to a local doctor, Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who was a great civil rights activist and had been a friend of the Emmett Till family. He had a clinic on the West Side and did many of the low-cost abortions, especially for black women who couldn't afford to travel outside of the state. So most of the referrals were out of state, but he Spencer Parsons made sure that locally there was an option for low-income women. Eventually, in 1970, the law was reformed in New York State and abortion was made legal, the clergy themselves opened a clinic in New York City. And after that, many of the chapters around the country sent women to that clinic where they would perform abortions for as little as $25 for indigent women. So even with the travel expenses, often it was the least expensive route for them to go.
D.A., what inspired you and Pat to look into this issue and write this book?
We are both what I would describe as amateur scholars. I mean, we've been to school, but we just sort of stumbled across this topic. Pat went to a commemorative Roe v. Wade celebration when we both lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And this topic was brought up, and Pat and I both, you know, could consider ourselves activists in many movements and feminists, and neither one of us had ever heard anything about this group. And so after Pat described the service to me and this group, I said, well, I wonder if anyone's ever written anything about this group. And it turns out that there was a very slim volume that had been written by Reverend Howard Moody and his co-conspirator Arlene Carmen shortly after Roe v. Wade. And that was really the only monograph that specifically talked about the work of the Clergy Consultation Service. There were articles and other books that mentioned the group, but nothing specifically dedicated to the history of this group. And so, you know, we both consider ourselves to be people of faith and activists and feminists. And we just thought, well, somebody needs to write this. And so we looked at each other and said, well, okay, let it be us. And so it became a labor of love. It's taken us about 15 years to actually go from inception of idea to publication of book.
And Pat, I wonder, as DA is talking about this, I wonder from your perspective, I'm just thinking also about all the conversations we're having now, particularly in Illinois with the Illinois legislature trying to pass laws that would preserve the legal right to have an abortion here in Illinois, regardless of federal law. I mean, we were talking about sort of 1967 versus now. Did you think when you were writing about this how much this might still be an issue today, Pat?
Well, we had hoped not. Even as we prepared the book for publication last year, we kind of assumed this would be just a needed footnote in history to make sure it was recorded. However, now it's beginning to look like a bit of a handbook and for activists today. And I think DA is better equipped to talk about the lessons that I think the Clergy Consultation Service have for us now.
DA?
Yeah, so we talk about the group as being a radical feminist populist group, and that is true, right? Especially because they were white, middle-class, middle-aged men for the most part, but they really were radical in that they advocated for the repeal of abortion law. They were populist in that they tried to serve women of all socioeconomic status, race, and ethnicities, and they were feminist. They really wanted to return power over abortion to women. And so lessons learned from that group, as well as women of color who talk about reproductive justice, that there really needs to be cross-movement activism around this topic. And, you know, we saw it within this group being activated around anti-war movement, civil rights movement. And I think that there is cross-movement possibilities, particularly for clergy, again, liberal clergy. We see that they've been active in the sanctuary movement, for example, and at various points from, you know, the legalization of Roe through now, clergy have talked about abortion access. But I think that there's an opportunity for, you know, inter-movement collaboration on rights across movements that could be reactivated. And, you know, this group shows an example of how that can happen, especially in terms of allyship or, you know, you don't need to identify with the group to be advocates for social justice for that group. And I think that this group demonstrated that.
That's D.A. Dirks, along with Pat Relf, co-authors of a new book just out. It's called To Offer Compassion, A History of Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. Pat, D.A., thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. all of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.